Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Welcome to New Books in Children's Literature. I'm host Susan Robb, and today we're talking with Jonathan Todres, who's a professor of law at Georgia State University College of Law. And we're talking about his book, which is brand new from Oxford University Press, entitled Human Rights in Children's Literature, Imagination and the Narrative of Law, which was written in cooperation with Sarah Higginbotham, and as I said, is just brand new this year. So, Jonathan, thank you for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
You know, there's a lot in here, and I have a lot of questions for you about, you know, both what people may be familiar with in the area of human rights as they relate to children, and also about how you see that tying in with the stories that we've told children as they've grown up. So first of all, one of the points you made that I thought was really interesting but true is that both lawyers and children's authors are storytellers. And one thing that you talk about right up front is you quote a favorite of mine, but Horton the Elephant, and you say there and later in the book, a person's a person no matter how small. And you said also in your preface that for you, this quote was a very particular articulation of the foundational principles of human rights in terms of equality, non-discrimination. And then you also quote Eleanor Roosevelt and talk about a quote that she gave that was very famous, where after all do human rights begin in small places close to home, so close and small they cannot be seen on maps of the world. And it talks about equal justice, equal opportunity, equal dignity without discrimination. So that brings up, why did you feel it was important to write this book, and why now?
Well, I'm glad you mentioned the quote from Horton, Here's a Who. That's one of my favorite quotes, the a person's a person no matter how small. And in many ways, that quote inspired the book. I have worked on children's rights issues, and in particular, issues of child exploitation for most of my career. And in recent years, I had moved towards focusing on prevention. How do we stop this harm from occurring in the first place? And a sort of foundational step, or a long-term step maybe, is that we need to build more rights-respecting communities and cultures. And so in some respects, this was a natural next step to think about how do children learn about their rights? How does the next generation or the younger generation learn about their rights, their responsibilities to respect the rights of others as well? And how do we build those communities? But in other ways, this came out about somewhat accidentally. I was in the library doing research one day, and I needed a break. So I walked around the library, and I came across Horton Hears a Who, which I remembered from childhood. So I decided to give myself a break from legal texts and just flip through the pages, thinking it's a nostalgic moment. And I came across that wonderful line, a person's a person no matter how small. And in that context, it hit me that I think Seuss just did a better job of explaining core principles of human rights than any legal philosopher had done in the last 100 years that I was aware of. So I started to pull other sources of children's books and collect books over time. And along the way, met my co-author, Sarah, and we decided to work together on an article. And after that was published, in 2013, we felt there was a a lot more to say, and we wanted to add an empirical component where we interviewed and read to children and asked them what they thought of these books, because part of children's rights is honoring what children think, and so we wanted to make sure that this wasn't just our interpretation. So ultimately that led to this book project, and Oxford was supportive, so that's where we are today.
Now, another thing you say in here is you talk about imagination being central to the integration of children's literature and children's rights. What do you mean by that?
Well, imagination is really important in childhood. Children are much more adept at moving from the real to the imaginative and back again than adults are. We tend to see them as sort of this bright line. And for children who are, you know, at different developmental stages, being able to go back and forth between the real and the imaginative world is important in the literature context, because they experience children's stories in a really profound way. They really immerse themselves in the stories. And so that's one of the reasons we thought that children's literature can be such a powerful medium for exposing children to human rights ideas and giving them a chance in a really safe space, the world of literature, to confront what is often some very difficult and challenging issues.
The another thing that you talk about here is about primary rights and rights that are subsets of those rights for children. So can you outline for people who may not be as familiar with the Declaration on Children's Rights, what sort of a little bit of a structure of what the rights are that are talked about?
Yeah, so the Convention on the Rights of the Child, a treaty adopted in 1989, and a treaty that is now the most widely accepted human rights treaty in history, every country in the world except one is a party to it now, has four sort of foundational principles, and they are the right to life, survival, and development, that every child should be able to grow up, have the necessary means to survive and develop to their full potential, that they should do this, that this should occur in a non-discriminatory manner, so this sort of non-discrimination, right to life, survival, and development. Third is that they have a right to participate in decisions that affect their lives. And then finally, that the best interest of the child should be a primary consideration. And those four operating together sort of form the framework for children's rights. And then there are more specific provisions on access to education, access to health care, juvenile justice, prevention of torture, and other sort of more specific rights.
And my understanding is that participation is one that has become stressed, maybe more now than before, the importance of children having a voice, which is interesting to me because that ties in with how children come across in the way that you've talked about in children's literature. You talk about, you know, Peter Rabbit, you talk about the role of adults in telling children early on to sort of sit down and be quiet. And now, you know, in this area too, we're saying, no, we really want to know what your opinions are.
Yeah, participation rights are foundational to democracy. They're important in human rights, and they likewise are important for children's rights. Now, because children are at a different stage developmentally, and we're talking about a really diverse group. 5-year-olds and 15-year-olds are very different. But the foundational idea in children's rights is that every child should have a right to participate in decisions that affect their life, the right to be heard, and that the weight given to that opinion depends on their age and maturity, but that they should at least, if they want, have that opportunity to participate. And I think you see that reflected in many children's stories, as you mentioned, you know, some of the earlier stories, Peter Rabbit, where the message really is to be, you know, children are to be seen and not heard. And Peter Rabbit's a good example. No child or no child character in Peter Rabbit speaks. Only adults have any voice at all. Horton Hears a Who, where the Who's, it's the smallest of the small that ultimately needs to be heard in order to save the Who's. It's JoJo with his yo-yo. That's a really powerful message to children that every child counts, and no matter how small. And we see that in many other stories. There's still modern stories today that tend towards seen and not heard, but we see an increasing number of stories today where there's recognition that children have something important to say about their own life experience and what happens to them.
And do you think we're listening to children at younger ages than we used to?
I hope so. I really hope so. I don't know with certainty. I think there's greater understanding in many circles that children have something important to say. In certain ways, they are experts on their own lives, if you will. They're learning, they're developing, they're testing ideas. Not every child's decision should be what's followed in every instance. But I think we are learning to, in many contexts, that children have something important to say. And I think it's also important, particularly as children grow and develop and age, to listen to children, because increasingly activities involving children often happen away from adults. And we see this with adolescents, that many of their activities and things that have significant influence on them happens in their peer group, away from adults. And if we're not listening to children, we don't know what they're responding to. We don't know what's happening to them. So I think there's real value in listening to children. And I think we definitely see in some spaces a much greater willingness to be open to what children have to say.
Yeah, it's interesting, because what I'm thinking as you're talking is about Malala, for example. There's also the change that children and young adults have potential to have a voice that gets heard in a much broader context now that we can communicate the way we do, and that it's not a communication that has to be filtered through another place.
That's exactly right. And I think one of the important findings in our project for this book, and I think more broadly, is that children are engaging these issues. They're confronting human rights issues in their everyday lives. They are they're confronting it in children's stories they read. And the question isn't so much as should we teach children about human rights. It's, in some respects, the question's really, they're already engaging these ideas. Do we as adults want to participate and facilitate this and support their learning and support their development as rights-respecting, rights-fulfilled individuals?
And how do you see some of that manifested in your area in the law?
Well, the law moves slowly sometimes, but I think there are opportunities in terms of this, the book project and related ideas, human rights education is really critical. The research on human rights education shows quite clearly that if you teach kids about their rights in a rights-respecting way, they tend to link rights and responsibilities more. They tend to demonstrate the fundamentals of good citizenship, and as compared with children who don't learn about human rights, those children tend to talk about rights as entitlements just for themselves. So human rights education is something that I think is really important, and law can support the development of and the implementation, whether it's in schools or other venues, to teach children about human rights. That's one critical step with law. Law can also help advance the rights of particular populations who, historically have been left out of human rights discourses or marginalized in other ways.
Now, when you were going through the literature, the body of work that you were looking at, were there rights topics that you felt were particularly lacking in the canon?
Well, I tend to think, you know, as a teacher, I tend to think anything can be an opportunity for learning. So the positive examples and the negative examples can both be the starting point for really wonderful conversations with children about rights. And we saw that when we read to children, sometimes we read books where it was less rights fulfilling, and you'd hear young kids say, "Well, that's not fair. He shouldn't be allowed to do that." And they're equally effective in certain ways at teaching rights. But I think one area where we see still a great need for progress is in the area on the issues of non-discrimination and equality, and in particular with diversity in children's literature. It continues to be, like other spaces in society, a place where there's a lack of diversity. Only a small percentage of books, even books published in the last two or three years, only a small percentage have characters that look like people of color. It's an overwhelmingly white industry still, and I think there's a great need for diversity. And so I think that's one space where there are still significant challenges. And we read more broadly on that chapter than we did in some of the other chapters to make sure that we were able to include some marginalized voices.
Now, if you were designing a curriculum, and I know that can be different age brackets, but if you had to pick some number of books that would be on your core list or authors, who would be on that or what would be on it?
Wow, that's a great question. There's so many books to choose from. Obviously there's several Dr. Seuss books. Yertle the Turtle is a favorite one of mine. I think Yertle the Turtle, Horton Hears a Who, they teach important participation rights. But I think I also think Click Clack Moo, Cows That Type is a great example. One of the things I like about Yertle the Turtle and Click Clack Moo as one example, or as two examples, is when they teach about rights, they're not just teaching about a single child's rights. So in Yertle the Turtle, if people remember the story, Yertle wants to continually stack turtles higher and higher to rule, a greater and greater kingdom. And it's Mac at the bottom of the stack, this tiny turtle, who ultimately is asserting his rights, but he's not just asserting his rights. He always uses the collective. We are starving down. We have rights. He's always talking not just about his rights, but also about the rights of the other turtles. And similarly, in Click Clack Moo, that's a story where the cows go on strike in the barn because they're cold at night and they want electric blankets. But they don't just advocate for themselves. It turns out the hens are also cold at night, and they too want electric blankets, so they advocate on behalf of others as well. And I think there's so many stories like that where you see child characters coming to the forefront and standing up not just for themselves but standing up for others. And I think those are a couple of great examples of what children's literature can teach. And the one other area I would say is I think children's literature is wonderful in terms of helping kids explore identity. And, a classic story there is the story of Ferdinand. He's the bull who didn't want to fight, although he may be the biggest, strongest bull. He just doesn't want to fight. And when we read that to younger kids as well as adolescents, they saw that very clearly as an identity rights book, being able to be who you are, being true to yourself. So I think there, the story of Ferdinand, and there are lots of other books that engage children about identity rights, and I think those are really important as well. Adolescence is a critical stage for identity formation. So I think that's a great area for children's literature.
Now, another thing you brought up, and I was laughing when I saw it because it is a classic aspect that people who work in children's literature absolutely know, is the role of adults in relation to children's, or to children. And so often in children's literature. It's very convenient to have children as abandoned or orphaned, or we could think of many, many examples of all of that. But you talk about that. You talk about the role of adults and children having a voice. So what's your feeling about that?
Yeah, we found that, you know, the adults, you know, fall broadly speaking into three categories. And you're absolutely right. In many, many stories, it's, you know, something tragic happens at the opening to the parents. And that, in a sense, you know, enables the child character to be the protagonist and not simply subsumed within the family. But so we see in children's literature, certainly many adult characters who are the perpetrators. They're the human rights violators. And we also see wonderful examples from Horton the Elephant to the Harry Potter stories. We see great examples of human rights protectors and those who advocate on behalf of children. But for me, one of the most interesting group, the third group that we sort of explored was particularly interesting. They're the sort of largely absent or in some cases incompetent parents, adults, who in some cases are like that throughout the story. And in other cases, in other stories, they have this wonderful growth during the story. As the narrative unfolds, we see them starting out incompetent and not really understanding or being engaged in the world of children. And then over time, coming to understand, in a sense, they've matured enough to understand the world of children and really support children in a much, much more rights-fulfilling way. And, you know, the classic example of that is The Little Prince, where it's the pilot who ultimately needs to sort of grow up to the level of the little prince and sort of return to his childhood to better understand smaller beings, if you will.
Now, another thing I noticed is you were talking about different categories where books fell in, or characters in some cases fell in to different aspects of the rights. So you have in terms of, you know, good, evil kind of adults, you have like Cruella de Vil, and you have the White Witch in Narnia, the Queen of Hearts in Alice in Wonderland, and then on the other side you talked about Horton, Mary Poppins, like that. And then you were talking about surrogates, adults who were surrogates, like in Charlotte's Web and in A Wrinkle in Time. But then in some of the other areas, you talked about, I was interested to find, for example, Curious George related to criminal justice, and Dr. DeSoto and Corduroy in relation to health, and then Rumpelstiltskin completely appropriately tied in with exploitation. So, can you talk a little bit about some of those different characters and how they exemplify the things that you think are important to share with children?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, as you were talking about different stories, I have this smile on my face because I think that's one of the wonderful things about this project and why I'm so excited about it is that, it reminds us of the stories we read as children, the stories we read to or have read to our children now. And what's really exciting, I think, is to see that, you know, the interpretations that we had, it was affirming to talk to children and hear that they had the exact same interpretation, but sometimes they saw something different, and they saw something different. When we read in small groups, sometimes the children would dispute, you know, amongst themselves, no, this really meant something positive. No, it didn't. And Curious George is a good example of that. And in the sort of original Curious George, he sees the man with the yellow hat dialing a telephone back in the days when when you know, telephones plugged into the wall and things like that. He's dialing, and he does what any child does. He just mimics an adult, and that's how they learn. And so he dials 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and somehow in the world of Curious George, that connects to the fire department. They run out thinking it's a fire, and they find, quote unquote, only a naughty monkey. And they have to, they say, we have to lock you up and throw you in jail. And that's what they do. And the next image, he's sitting there looking very sad in this sort of gray, you know, cinder block prison with mice in one corner. And, you know, it's really, you know, for me, that sort of, you know, when we think about juvenile justice and sort of punishment of children for wrongdoing, that, you know, I find not particularly helpful, never mind due process rights and things like that. You know, they never really explained to Curious George what he did wrong so he can learn. And but when we read to a group of students about, you know, we'd say, so what did you think of the story? And, you know, that was a really fun day because they remembered reading it when they were younger, and this was a little bit older kids. And they said, you know, well, why didn't they just give him time out? You know, that seems unfair. Why did they put him in jail? You know, all he was doing what the man with the yellow hat did. And why is he treated differently and punished for that? And then there was one student who eventually chimed in and said, well, you know, he's just a silly monkey. This, you know, it's just a silly story. It's nothing more. And so, you know, there are different interpretations. And what I hope with this project really is just to start conversations. I think it's important that children learn about their own rights and their responsibility to respect the rights of others. And I think children's literature, doing it through children's literature and having those dialogues through children's literature, is meeting children where they are and with the materials that they're excited about. And I imagine we'll get different interpretations, and that's okay, because respecting their opinion is part of fulfilling their rights.
And what have you seen in or heard in the conversations in terms of the connection between reading stories and fostering empathy?
Yeah, so there's pretty good evidence now that reading does, in fact, foster empathy and make one more empathetic. And I think that makes sense. I mean, reading, and we talked earlier about imagination, reading transports all of us, and particularly younger individuals and children, it transports them, and you're able to be introduced to characters who may look different from you. You're able to understand what a character feels. I think children feel very, when they see Curious George sitting in jail, looking very sad, they really feel that. They're not being told that. They can experience that. And Seuss is similar in the sense that, you know, Seuss had this mandate, nothing can be in the text that isn't in the pictures. So that even the pre-reading child can follow along, and they're in fact ahead because they're absorbing what's in the picture and they're experiencing it. You know, the research shows that reading fosters empathy. And when we think about it, when we see kids reading, we see how they talk about the stories. It's no surprise. They really immerse themselves in these characters, and they learn about a world beyond their bedroom or their home or their classroom. And they, you know, it makes sense that they develop greater empathy for others.
Now, many of the issues raised in the book have been in the news this election. I mean, things like respecting others, language, the idea of identity and citizenship. And what are your thoughts about this in the context of teaching children about rights?
Well, I think some of the rhetoric of the current campaign has made it challenging, to say the least, in terms of using these, you know, I think I know a number of teachers who have always used the election as a starting point for a number of conversations, and the rhetoric has become so awful and offensive in many instances that it becomes hard for them to use that in the classroom. And, you know, there was a story just in the last week showing that this is having an effect on classroom behavior, on bullying. And anecdotally, teachers are reporting that bullying has increased in their classroom. And as they suspect, in part because they're seeing adults model this. I think, if anything, this, you know, the rhetoric and the discourse today in politics is sort of a call for human rights education. We need to introduce children and adolescents to these ideas in a rights-respecting way, that, you know, teach them not only about their own rights, but also about their responsibilities to respect the rights of others. And that can start earlier. There's some wonderful classroom examples of projects that have been done in various countries where kids as young as 4 or 5, you may not talk about it as technical human rights law, but you can talk about the principles of human rights. And young kids can understand what's fair, what's just, and what's unfair. And it may be that I'm limiting this too much, and that human rights education, in light of what some of the adults in the on the campaign trail are saying, human rights education should probably not be limited to children, but maybe all of us as adults should go through a human rights education course as well.
Figure it couldn't hurt, huh? I guess with that, are there some particular books that jumped out at you that if a teacher was looking for something, for example, that might help address things like rhetoric and language? Are there, I don't mean to put you on the spot, but are there some things you came across that particularly address that?
You know, we mentioned there are a number of books. You know, we were sort of cautious about, you know, is this the time to do a recommended list? You know, both Sarah and I had our personal favorites, of course, but we sort of stopped short of doing a recommended list. I think that, you know, this can be addressed on a number of levels. Take the issue of diversity, right? So there are certain books that more clearly state are sort of a statement or a lesson about diversity and the importance of diversity. I think one of the things that children respond to is when the story is foregrounded, when it's not one of those really obvious hit you over the head lessons dressed up as a children's story, but it's really a story. And that's where I think something like the story of Ferdinand and Click Clack Moo and others, those are more effective because the story engages kids and then they learn. I think the other thing about, you know, staying on the point about diversity is sometimes it's not even that the story has to have the lesson of diversity. And we can think of the classic Snowy Day, which is this story, you know, Peter goes out to play in the snow, and Peter's a small young African-American boy. And the story makes no comment on, there's nothing relevant to the story about his skin color. It's just, you know, there's a character who's African-American, right? And I think there are a lot of stories that, you know, they're not, well, there need to be more, but there are good examples of stories like that where this is just part of the fabric of life. And I think those stories are important as well, so that we don't think that, okay, now we're going to read the story where there are characters who are people of color and this is the story about diversity. But no, like many of the stories we read, we see children who look like different people from around the world, and that's just an ordinary day, and sort of normalizing diversity instead of making diversity this sort of side lesson. I think sometimes just incorporating it as part of the everyday fabric is what's important.
Yeah, and it's, and another thought that I had is that also there's a whole other aspect of children's literature, a whole other portion of nonfiction that brings out the stories of things that have happened over time. I mean, I'm thinking of Marilyn Nelson's book, A Wreath for Emmett Till, or Brave Girl, which talks about the immigrant story and the labor protest, and so different things like that. And I think that there are a lot of different ways to come at it.
Right. And there are, you know, stories, some really wonderful books about the internment camps around World War II. John Lewis, you know, who happens to be my congressman, but was sort of far more important, one of the sort of great civil rights leaders and longtime congressman, has written a graphic novel, March, that is his story. And so there are many of those stories where it is a sort of based on a true story, or in fact nonfiction, but done in a child-friendly format. And I think those are really important as well.
Mm-hmm. What about organizations that parents could turn to, or teachers could turn to, if they either want to learn more or perhaps get involved with human rights for children?
Well, I tend to think of that really broadly. So the first thing I would wonder is if they are interested in particular issues. There's Human Rights Education Associates. Does human rights education training, and that might be of interest to people who are wanting to draw upon lessons and curriculum on this topic. And there's also wonderful materials that UNICEF has created on child-friendly versions of the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which is the human rights treaty we talked about earlier, and lesson plans for different age group kids. So those are some great materials. I'm also, I'm thinking about sort of follow-on projects to this book. There are a couple of different things I'm doing, and one of the things that I'm trying to do on my website is pull together resources about human rights and children's literature, and it's at a very early stages now, but also going to have teaching materials, and there's a space where I'll expect to do recommended book lists. And so those, you know, that's an opportunity if people want to take a look at my website, and there's a space where people can suggest ideas if they have ideas for favorite books that engage human rights issues.
And then what about children themselves? I mean, I know Amnesty International, but are there other kinds of things that if someone has a child that is interested in getting involved in human rights, either here or internationally, where they could go to?
Yeah, I mean, I think UNICEF's one starting point in terms of connecting with organizations. There are a lot of the U.S. Human Rights Network, which has offices here in Atlanta. There, as you mentioned, Amnesty has some has sort of local chapters that are both university level and young high school level groups as well. There are lots of opportunities. You know, different organizations. I serve on the board of advisors of ECPAT USA, which is Ending Child Prostitution and Trafficking, an organization that works to stop child trafficking in the U.S. And they, from time to time, have projects that engage young people as well. So a lot of the organizations that may not sort of formally have a youth participation component look to do outreach on a regular basis, and I think would welcome that participation.
So, and then tied in with that, I was going to ask you how you thought your book might be used, where you've been seeing it used, and where you'd like to see it.
Well, you know, the starting point is sort of a modest goal. I just want people, you know, I'd love to have people see the book and read the book and then just start a conversation with the people in their communities. I really hope, and I've been excited that so far we are reaching teachers, and the book's now on paperback, and that will be helpful to teachers. I know teachers have sort of limited resources to, in many instances. So I'm excited to reach teachers. I had a conversation with a fifth grade art teacher in Louisiana who was excited about the book and thinking about how can I use some of the ideas to teach human rights through the arts. And I think that, you know, we often think about human rights, if we're thinking about school curriculum and school subjects, we often think, oh, you have to teach human rights as, you know, civil rights through your social studies class. And I think, our project on children's literature shows that you could teach human rights through an English class. You could teach human rights through a math class. There's any subject can be this basis for engaging children on these ideas and ultimately empowering them in sort of really important ways to not only to, you know, exercise their rights, but to help advocate for the rights of others.
So I guess, first I wanted to thank you for both talking about this, but also about the work that you did. I know, you know, looking at the literature in the context of all of this was a very big project. And what I'm hoping is that it'll give people ideas so that people who do care about this, which is hopefully most of us or all of us, can move the conversation forward in a lot of different ways and work together because, you know, as we were talking about earlier, it's a critical thing, not just in this country, but abroad. So thank you for talking about all of this.
Thank you so much. I'm excited about sort of and now see this book as sort of the first step in a much longer term project. So I'd love to hear from individuals. I'm sort of in the early stages of a project on global perspectives on children's stories, both oral and written storytelling traditions. So I'm excited and I would love to hear from individuals who are thinking about these ideas or want to think about these ideas.
Oh, good. So that leads me to my next question is where can people find you? What website or how best for them to get in touch with you?
Sure. The easiest way to get in touch with me is my website, jonathantodres.com. That's JonathanTodres.com. I'm also easy to find. I'm at Georgia State University's Law School. That's where I teach. So I'm the only Jonathan on faculty. So if you can't even remember my last name but you remember Georgia State University College of Law and Jonathan, then you can find me easily and you can email me. I'm happy to hear from people in any way, Twitter. These conversations really excite me and I love hearing what ideas people have. So I welcome any feedback.
Well, thanks, Jonathan. I'm looking forward to you and I meeting soon, too. We're going to be meeting around human rights as well. But thank you for talking with me about all of this and, look forward to hearing more about what you're doing in this.
Thank you so much, Susan. I really appreciate it.